ChatGPT has two components of how it works. Mm-hmm. So one thing I'll note, like right off the bat, is there are no like humans behind the scenes like powering things or like changing things manually. Everything is from these models that just learn from lots and lots of data. To like challenge yourself when you maybe like don't want to be challenged. And so I would also encourage students to think about, you know, don't think about how can I use ChatGPT to help me cheat on my homework. Think about how can I use ChatGPT to improve my learning experience. I think we'll continue to see the technology improve. And what that means as well is that we as humans, or like we as society, will have to sort of co-evolve with the technology.
Okay, I think we'll start now. People will continue to join. Welcome everyone for joining to our next version of the Spheres of Learning talk from MySphere. As you know, MySphere is a digital portfolio platform for students to build on their portfolio. And it also connects students to career counselors, different courses, different career paths, enables them to look at different career paths. The Spheres of Learning talks is a platform that MySphere hosts every month, where we have people from different walks of life talk to us live, and students or principals can and career counselors can join the platform and ask the mentor about different things, and you know, so that they can also give guidance to the students. Towards the end of the talk, we will also open it up for audience verbal questions. But during the talk, you all are welcome to put your questions on chat, and I will when I'm interviewing the guest bring it up as relevant as well. Right. So this is the format of the talk today. Now let me introduce our guest speaker, Vineeth Kosaraju. He's from OpenAI. He's from the Math Gen team at OpenAI. He's a graduate of, he's done both his bachelor's and master's in computer science from Stanford. He grew up in Silicon Valley, and he's been at OpenAI for the past few years. And as you know, OpenAI has, taken the world by storm with release of its ChatGPT, which is just a few months ago. And we thought it was very appropriate to invite a person from OpenAI who is also very young and, you know, from an age difference perspective, close to many of you in the audience, or many of the educators in the audience can relate to what are these careers in AI that everyone talks about going to potentially change the world. So with that short introduction, Vineeth, welcome again to MySphere. Thank you for the opportunity to be part of the to invite you to the platform.
Thanks, Rish. Really excited to be here.
Thanks. So can you tell me a little bit about your own journey, Vineeth, about, you've done some internships, you did some interesting stuff at high school. In fact, I have a short video that you had shared earlier that I will play. But can you, in your own words, tell the audience a little bit about yourself? Yeah.
Sure. I got into computer science at a relatively young age, actually just through like playing video games with my friends. Uh-huh. I think I transitioned sort of naturally there from playing video games to wanting to make video games. And from there, just got really excited about computer science and programming and all the aspects that go into that. So throughout high school, worked on a few different projects. The one I was like most proud about was, as I was picking up these new programming skills, I would host these local sessions with a friend, where we would teach these skills to other kids, to kids in the community, to kids from underprivileged or disadvantaged communities, try to get them as interested in computer science as we were. So that was sort of my like path early on. Was very fortunate to be able to go to Stanford, where I really continued more down that path of computer science, found an interest in artificial intelligence, did some research while I was in university there, also continued teaching, really enjoyed both aspects of that, spent some time working over the summers, spent a few summers over at Google, spent a summer over at Tesla, really learned a lot from those opportunities, and then ended up being very, very fortunate to join OpenAI at such a at such an interesting time a few years ago.
Okay. That's pretty cool. I want to now share with the audience one of the videos that you shared with us. 1 second. Can see the screen, right?
Yep.
Please share with the sound.
The city of Cupertino is situated at the center of Silicon Valley.
Sorry.
The city of Cupertino is situated at the center of Silicon Valley, the home of many famous tech companies. Everyone in the community considers themselves very fortunate to live in one of the most affluent areas of the country and attend some of the best schools that the US has to offer. Because of the opportunities provided to us due to our location, many people take up computer programming as a hobby at a young age, and older students are always eager to introduce them to the world of technology. Math and Coding is an organization founded by local high school students Nikhil Chirla and Vineet Kosaraju. The goal of the organization is very simple, teaching young people how to code. In what ways are people's lives benefited by the knowledge of programming?
When you learn how to program, it teaches you how to be methodical. It teaches you how to organize your thoughts in like a organized manner. And it really gives you all of these life skills. So whether you're gonna like major in STEM or not, you still need programming. It helps their future in a major way.
How early do you believe programming should be introduced to kids?
You know, programming at a younger age is definitely a must. I mean, all the top companies, all the top founders of companies, they all believe that programming should be introduced at a young age. I mean, there's no really like negative of programming. It really just helps you think better, gives you a better logic skill set. It's really just a better way to learn.
As a teenager, did you feel that it was difficult to form an organization like this?
Well, I really think it's about the motivation and the passion you have for something. If you have enough passion for something, then it's really going to you're not really going to find that many difficulties. Sure, you might find some roadblocks in the path you take, but in the end, everything's going to be all right. So Nikhil and I were really motivated to start Coding for Kids, and eventually we managed to do it. So I wouldn't say that age was really a roadblock, but it's just like having dedication and having time.
After interviewing Nikhil and Vineet, it became obvious that people should use their knowledge that they acquire in school to help and benefit those willing to learn. Interviewing Nikhil made us realize that introducing programming to young children opens many new doors. The fact is, programming is an essential skill for young students to have early in their education, as it helps tremendously in areas such as math, problem solving, and creative collaboration with peers. Nikhil is a young visionary who changed the standards by creating his organization. But the truth is that any student who has a unique skill set can reach out to the community and help others. Whether it be programming, playing golf, photography, or even basket weaving, every student in the country has the power to change lives of those around them. After all, knowledge is power, and those armed with knowledge can more readily achieve success.
Well, that is great.
Thank you. That was a few years ago, but
yeah, I know. You even look different, you know. So you used to do this in libraries and community libraries and teach kids coding and on games.
That's correct.
Across different languages and things. Yeah. Okay. And that's where you then started developing thing. How did it move from gaming to AI? How did your interest move? Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. It was actually like very fortunate, I think. During the time during the time I was in high school, there were all these new like news articles and papers and blog posts coming out about all these new advances coming out in AI. I think right around 2015 or so, actually, was this very pivotal moment in AI where the first image recognition models were really becoming really powerful. And so I think that like really sparked my interest in the field. It was no longer, you know, well, this is something in science fiction. It was, this is something that like people are working on right now and making real progress on. And if I really dedicate myself and challenge myself, then maybe I'll be able to work on it one day too.
Okay, so for the lay audience, can you kind of explain a little bit on what AI really is, and then how a chatbot like ChatGPT and then maybe others as well, you know, how does it all play in, and how does it actually work?
Yeah, definitely. I'd say the term AI itself is very broad. It's encompassed a field that's been around for many, many decades at this point. Most of the advances that we see today are from a subset of AI called machine learning, and really a subset within machine learning called deep learning. And so the core technique that's powering all these advances is this one algorithm, this idea of a neural network. Without like going into too many details, the like main insight or the main reason it works is it's something where you show it a lot of examples of some kind of input, and you show it a lot of examples of some kind of output that you want desired. So maybe you show it like a lot of images of like different cats and different dogs, and the output is like whether the image has a cat or a dog in it. And the really interesting thing is if you just have enough examples, enough of this data, and you also have enough computing power, then these models tend to work really, really well, maybe even human level. And so this is something that like started happening around like 2015 or so is when it really started to take off. And this is the core fundamental technique that's powering things like ChatGPT. So to get a little bit more technical, ChatGPT has two components of how it works. So one thing I'll note like right off the bat is there are no like humans behind the scenes like powering things or like changing things manually. Everything is from these models that just learn from lots and lots of data. And so there are these two stages. One is this pre-training stage. That's the one on the top here of this slide. And so what we do is we take all of the language that's out there on the internet. So this could be like Wikipedia articles, this could be magazines, news articles, books, textbooks, whatever it is, you name it. And we teach these models to do this input-output task of given an input sentence, something like the quick brown fox jumps over the lazy blank, learn to predict what the next word in that sentence is gonna be. So in this case, the next word is dog. And so one thing that's really interesting is if you do this at a full internet scale, learning from thousands, if not millions or billions of different documents, these models really start to understand the core principles of language. They really understand like the different vocabulary, like what does it mean to be a dog? What does it mean to be a cat? They really understand some of the like subtleties around like grammar, like adjectives versus verbs versus clauses. Versus prepositions, they get really good at this like sentence completion task, like predicting what the next word is, but they also understand a lot about the language that exists on the internet and the humans that put that language out there.
So how does but I would imagine, let's say in English, there could be potentially four or five different words that complete some sentence, you know, maybe the quick brown fox jumps over the lazy dog is the normal thing, but maybe it's a lazy cat, you know, in the context that I'm talking about. So how does ChatGPT and models, how do they really figure out what I want to, you know, the context of the question?
Yeah, that's a really good observation. So part of this is the, just like you mentioned, the context of the question. So maybe you've already had part of a conversation with ChatGPT already. And so like previously in the conversation, maybe you've already been talking about dogs or like pets around the house. And so it knows that you're more likely to want to continue talking about dogs. For a lot of these things, I would say as well that maybe there are like two or five or like many different possible answers for like what the next word could be. Right. And so this is something you might actually see with ChatGPT as well, where you give it the exact same prompts twice and it might give you two different answers. Okay. So there is actually some element of randomness there.
So so then you're saying that the same person can ask the same question and get two different answers, maybe minutes from each other. And then different people can also get different answers for the same thing. How does it work?
Yeah, the same person could get two different answers within minutes, within even seconds of each other. Two different people could get two different answers. So maybe like in, given this sentence, we know, say there's like an 80% chance that the next word is dog and right. a 20% chance that the next word is cat. So maybe 80% of the time the model will say, I'm going to output dog because I think that the next word is most likely dog. And then the 20% of the time it'll say cat. And so this is just over one word, but if you do this over many, many words repeatedly, having like this little bit of randomness, then you might get different conversations, different answers. Part of this randomness is very natural. So if the prompt is, you know, write a poem for me in the, write a poem for me that has three lines. You don't want the same poem every time, or right. you don't want the same poem for many different people as well. And so there's a lot of this like natural randomness out there on the internet. Definitely like a lot of sentences that start off the same but end completely different ways. And so this is also reflected in something like ChatGPT as well.
Interesting. And so when you said that you pre-trained data, right, for a long period of time, what is the kind of time that you're talking about to pre-train data? And then how old is that data? And you know, with the rapid change of information that gets generated every day, you know, around the world, you know, is the plan then to keep up so that it's then real time at some point?
Yeah, that's a really good question as well. So I think this is a really big problem, this question of how stale the data is. So for something like ChatGPT, I forget the exact date, but maybe all this like pre-training data was collected before 2022. Okay. And so the model knows about current events that happened in 2021, but if you ask it about something that happened last year, it will make up information, or it might say that event didn't happen. So I think this is very much a big problem right now. And definitely something that we want to improve in the future.
Okay. I think I interrupted you just when you were explaining the pre-training. Maybe you can go on to the rest of the thing. Yes. Yeah.
Sure. Yeah. So I would say most of the data, most of the compute that's being spent is in this pre-training stage. And then there's this like separate fine-tuning stage after, where we don't want the model to just output things that look like they were written on the internet. You know, the internet has a lot of problems. A lot of people write bad stuff on the internet. A lot of stuff on the internet is inaccurate. And so there's the second fine-tuning stage of now that we have this really cool model that like understands language, how do we actually get it to be factual? How do we get it to output things that humans actually like? And so ideally what we would do is we would take the model, we would give it to some humans, we would ask them whether they like it or not. All the things that the humans like, we would like reward the model for. Everything that the humans don't like, we would punish the model for. You know, the same way you might do that with like a pet or like an animal.
Right.
this idea of like learning from positive or negative reinforcement. So it turns out there are actual algorithms devoted to that. It's a very interesting field called reinforcement learning. And so that's a technique we use. Instead of giving it directly to humans though, which is a little expensive, what we do instead is we first train this reward model. So that's the section in the middle, where we take a small set of prompts, something like explain the moon landing to a six-year-old. And we ask humans to rate which of many responses from this model are seem good, which ones seem bad. And so we have this, what we call a reward model that knows this is what humans like, this is what humans don't like. And then so to train the ChatGPT model, instead of asking humans directly, hey, here's a new prompt that we've never seen before. Is this something is this response something that's good or something that's bad? Instead of having to wait for like a human to give that kind of feedback, we can now ask this reward model, what would a human have predicted? Would this response actually have been good or not? Can we use that information to now improve the ChatGPT model?
So, whenever I've tried to interact with ChatGPT, irrespective of the question I ask, it kind of waits for 2 or 3 seconds, and then it starts, even if you told it to give you a chapter, within 3 seconds, it's already started writing. And, how does it do all of this in 3 seconds?
Yeah, sorry, I should clarify. So all this pre-training and fine-tuning happens beforehand.
Okay.
So before ChatGPT is even created, this is the process which is created.
Okay.
And then the only thing that happens when you submit some kind of question or some kind of input is this, that is fed as input to the model. Uh-huh. And then the model goes through this prediction task of like predicting what the next word should be.
Okay.
And so now instead of predicting what the next word will look like on the internet, which is what you get from pre-training, now it's predicting what the next word will look like such that humans will like the response, which is what you get from this fine-tuning stage. Okay. But it's very fast because you're not doing any of this training. There's no like humans involved in the loop. The model's already been trained, and you're passing the input through it, getting the output quickly. And then as soon as you choose what that next word is, as soon as the model chooses what the next word is, then it repeats and gets the next word after that. And that's why you can see the words sort of streaming in quickly.
And so unlike, let's say, chess, where you can't play chess unless you thought through seven moves ahead, maybe, and maybe it's more for the grandmasters, I don't know. But, you can never win a game of chess where you're only doing one step at a time, right? But ChatGPT does only one word at a time, is it?
Correct. ChatGPT only predicts one word at a time.
Wow. And it's still sort of so powerful. I don't know. So this is something that people need to really start absorbing right from the layman, right? Because one is using the product, but you're saying that everything at the behind the scenes, it's just actually generating really, really quickly from pre-trained and fine-tuned data, one word at a time, right? And this is only English for now, but it can go to other languages as well.
Correct. Right? Yeah. Yeah. So it has been trained on data from some other languages, just by virtue of having been trained on the internet. Uh-huh. But the primary focus for now is English. I think the hope is definitely to improve it in other languages as well.
Okay. So right now, it seems to be kind of fun tool that people are using to either say wow or just get really scared. Where do you see all of this going over time? Right.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting question. I do think there are some very interesting applications of how it's being used today. Things like debugging code for people who English isn't their first language, helping rewrite things from their words to like better sounding English or more natural sounding English. So right now I would say there's maybe like some tasks that it helps with, but maybe also just for a lot of reasons, it's just fun to play around with. But I do think that what we'll see is this technology will only continue to improve. Mm-hmm. Maybe it will be like a gradual improvement over the course of years. Maybe it will be more rapid than that. But I would be very surprised if the like set of tasks that it can do today is the only set of tasks that it remains able to do in, say, 5 years. I think we'll continue to see the technology improve. And what that means as well is that we as humans, or like we as society, will have to sort of co-evolve with the technology. I think it will help us do a lot of jobs. It will make our lives easier when we're doing a lot of jobs. But it also means we'll have to rethink what if the technology is doing some of the work in those jobs, what are the humans doing?
Right. That's or, a real fear across the world, I think. Yeah.
So what are
OpenAI's visions on that, on how, you know, how society, you know, I'm assuming that all companies try and make things for the good of the world, right? And so how do you kind of deal with that question, right? Not your, you know, you can give your personal answer, not your, you know, yeah.
Yeah. So one thing I will definitely say is it's very hard to get things right on your first try. And so that was a big intention of why we released this technology to begin with. Uh-huh. As hard as it's going to be to adapt to this version of the technology with its benefits, but also its the reasons why it's like not great sometimes. Mm-hmm. We can imagine like an alternate world where instead of releasing this, we release one in 5 years, and people haven't had time to get used to the like implications of this technology or what it means for jobs or for education. And so I think one thing the company really wants to see is this like gradual evolution of, you know, as these systems get more and more capable, let's also put them into the hands of real people as fast as we can. Do so in a way that's safe, but also in a way that allows us to learn how humans and AI can sort of work together, as opposed to AI just displacing humans. So I think that's our hope in the short term, that by gradually releasing this technology with its benefits and with its flaws, we will be able to learn more and achieve a better outcome than you know, if we just released something truly transformative that like took over the entire world. As for my the like long-term vision, I think our like eventual hope is this technology is does become really powerful and really useful for everyone. So any kind of profession is able to use this technology, is empowered to use this technology. So that's maybe our hope, which is also good for us because we're creating the technology, but I think remains to see like what the actual impacts will be.
So you talked about, because of this kind of the large language learning model where you're predicting a word, you can still, mm-hmm. you know, ChatGPT and other chatbots like it can still be wrong, right? And then, mm-hmm. So what are the known things that it currently kind of doesn't do that well, or mm-hmm. maybe wrong? And I don't know, it itself kind of states that to some of the questions, I think, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a really good question. So I think some of this is what we were talking about earlier, actually, that a lot of this data was collected at a very fixed point in time. And so mm-hmm. the model is not going to know about current events. It's not going to be able to answer accurately about the something that happened yesterday, for example. Instead, it'll just make up information. So I think that's like one particularly big flaw. Another is I think these models are really good at doing things like writing poems, rewriting sentences, but maybe not as good as something as simple as like solving math problems. So you ask it to do like you give it an equation and you ask it to solve for the roots of the equation. And maybe it'll just make up an answer instead of giving you the actual answer.
Really? So that's pretty interesting. I would think that math is very deterministic and that would be easier to model. Is that not right?
Mm-hmm.
As opposed to writing a poem, which needs creativity.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think there's a few aspects there. One is there's some math out there on the internet, but not too much. And there's more examples of like poetry and essays. And I think there's just like more data to learn about language than there is to learn about math. And unfortunately, like a lot of the examples of math you see on the internet are incorrect examples of math. Either like people asking for help or people making like silly arithmetic mistakes. So maybe even the model's like picking up on some of that. I think the like other thing that's really challenging is in poems, there's not really like one right answer. So if you like make a mistake in the middle, it can often be reasonable to continue with that mistake and you'll still find like a very interesting poem at the end of it. Or even like the concepts of a mistake isn't really like well-defined in the context of a poem. Whereas in math problems, there's, you know, just one correct answer. If you make a mistake, it's very obvious that you've made a mistake. And so the like bar for reliability or the bar for, always be correct, never make mistakes, is much higher for math problems than say writing a poem.
And so you're part of the math gen team. So that's the kind of stuff that you work on?
Yeah, exactly. So part of the math gen team at OpenAI, our main focus is how do we get these models to do better at reasoning tasks, in particular math problems? Uh-huh. And the hope is if we can make it do better at like reliably solving these math problems, you know, not making a single mistake, maybe we can also, maybe that same technique would also allow it to be more reliable at other tasks. So maybe like writing code or, doing some kind of analysis, running experiments, whatever it might be. So whatever degree this like reliability is a concern right now, it's something that we see in math problems. So that's where we're starting off with, but would love to gradually improve that as we continue to make these models better and better.
So the other question is, how do you see this changing different industries? Like we talked about, it's currently a tool that everyone's kind of just playing around, but is it going to, and you talked a little bit about potentially, help different industries can reinvent them, will need to reinvent themselves in a way in order to how to use a tool like ChatGPT. But so before you go there, now when the internet came and then let's say search came and, people started using, some of the popular search tools. So what's the difference between something like search and something like ChatGPT?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think they're both tools and tools that maybe accomplish different things. So in my mind, search is more about, I have some information that I want to find out more about, or I have a question I want answered. And I want to find sources that are talking about that information. So how do I retrieve those sources? And those sources could be websites, could be like articles, could be journals, whatever it might be. But it's given some sort of topic, find each of these like independent sources. And the role I see something like ChatGPT playing is a little, I think the difference is a little subtle, but it does exist, which is I have something I want to learn more about. Take all this information and just synthesize it for me. Don't give me the different sources, but combine all the information and teach me about the topic. Maybe even like teach me about something that I didn't even know I wanted to know more about. And so I think those are like subtly different. There's some times where you might want those original sources. Say you're like writing a paper and you like want to do a deep dive into the history of something, or you want to like follow one of those sources and see where they got their sources from. And so there, I think like thinking about search as a tool is still really powerful. But likewise, I think there will be applications of something like ChatGPT, where instead of searching for something, what you really want is to be able to like chat with a friend, or like with a tutor, with a teacher, with a fellow student, about some topic and learn something new from the synthesis of everything the model knows about that topic.
And I guess that over time, search and this will all merge. That's what we read in the press, of course, right?
I don't know. I think it's definitely hard to predict what the eventual outcome will be, but there's definitely a lot of smart people working on that, both at OpenAI and at other companies, figuring out like what is the best way of making these tools useful for humans, whether that's like search alone or chat alone or some combination of the two.
Okay.
I think everyone's motivated by this question of, we have this really cool technology coming soon. How do we make this actually useful for people?
So, by the way, people in the audience, y'all can, put your questions on chat, and we'll happy to have the guests answer some or most of them. Right. So here's a question, representing some of the audience. Many of the educators, when something like ChatGPT gets released, they're a little fearful on, well, is this going to have students just not do homework and just submit the answers from, it took them 5 seconds to maybe retype even, somebody, in fact, even sent me a video of it taking it the input from ChatGPT and having a 3D printer robot write it out in hand, all kinds of videos are floating around now. So the question is, if you were an educator, what would you tell an educator about this technology and how schools and teachers can actually use this in order to better their lives, right? And in fact, not be threatened by this in a way. Yeah. And maybe there's some things from a regulation perspective, banning it during school time and, all kinds of things. So there's going to be regulation in all of this as well. And that's already starting to happen. But how do you, there's some things when there's a genie out of the bottle and you want to figure out how this new landscape, how we are all going to adapt, mm-hmm. right? So your views on that.
Right. I think you hit the nail on the head. I think the concerns from educators are definitely very well intentioned and very well deserved. So a lot of what we've been doing with this initial release has actually been collaborating with educators, figuring out ways to improve their workflows as opposed to harm their workflows. So I know that there have been like a few instances of like teachers or administrators using it to design new curriculum or using it with students to provide like more one-on-one tutoring or more one-on-one teaching. I think the like really interesting thing about this technology is you can scale like a lot of the like one-on-one interactions you have with teachers and students to like identify what each student is like really passionate about, and then maybe there the human teacher can step in and also help the student. So I think some of it is, teachers can use, it's not just like students using this as a tool to like cheat on homework. Maybe teachers or administrators can use this as a tool as well, both with interacting with students and coming up with new curriculum. I think for the student aspect, I think there have been like a variety of strategies used already. So like banning it during school hours or like on school campus. Maybe for some exams, you want it to be like just pen and paper, or like computers are okay, but like no access to the internet, and that's fine. I think like one thing to keep in mind as well, though, is that we hope to continue making this technology more and more useful, not just like as a fun thing to play around with, but something that people will actually use in their real jobs. So if people do end up using this technology in their jobs and their careers, then maybe it is also good to teach about it in schools and classes. I think like within the classroom itself is a really interesting area to figure out what's the best way that these humans and models can collaborate. I think the like final thing I'll say there is that students are, I think, very good at cheating when they want to. I say this as someone who's been a student in the past. I think,
but I know you've not cheated, but anyway. Yeah. Okay.
I think a lot of what important to remember, speaking to students here, is that what you get out of your education is what you really like put into it. So maybe for some things, like it is very like easy to cheat, but that like deprives you of the learning that you could have gotten in that topic. And so maybe for some things you're okay with that, but I think it is really important to like challenge yourself when you maybe like don't want to be challenged. And so I would also encourage students to think about, you know, don't think about how can I use ChatGPT to help me cheat on my homework. Think about how can I use ChatGPT to improve my learning experience? How do I use it to discover a new topic I'm passionate about? How do I use it to dive deeper into a topic I'm interested in, but is hard for me to learn about? Really use it to like augment your learning experience.
But that's what's going to
the cheating aspect.
Yeah, and that's where they're going to get ahead in life anyway, right? If they really learn how to actually ask it questions so that, you know, today's thing is not as important as what they're picking up for the future.
Yeah, definitely.
And are there things going to be like plagiarism tools so that you can tell whether this answer is being generated by a chatbot?
Definitely those as well. That's something we're actively researching. Figuring out like how can people tell if an output came from a human or from one of these like AI models. You know, this is not just important for education, but also if people want to generate like fake news or misinformation or like hate speech on the internet, it's important to know whether that's coming from humans or whether that's coming from models. Definitely something we're researching very heavily right now.
Because I would imagine even the college application process where people, you know, write essays and things, you know, it's going to be now, plagiarism is going to be an important tool that will need to be developed along with this plagiarism detection tools. Yeah.
Definitely.
Okay. So any questions from the audience? And then, you know, we'll also... how does ChatGPT work on neural networks? How does this model differentiate itself from heuristic-based models, even if it uses the same type of data? This is a question from the chat.
Yeah. So ChatGPT itself is a neural network. So no necessary distinction there. The one thing I'll say there is ChatGPT is like generally within this category of large language models. And the really important word there is the word large. I would say this is sort of a new term that's come around in the past maybe like a couple years or so. What researchers have found out is that as you make these neural networks larger in terms of how many parameters they have, or larger in terms of how much data you train them on, or larger in terms of how much compute you spend on them, the performance tends to improve pretty on this task of like learning more about language. And so ChatGPT itself is one of the like large language models, implying that large means it's been trained on a lot of data, is a relatively big model. There have been other large language models in the past. So some from OpenAI, some from Google, a lot of other tech companies have built models in the space. To that extent, like ChatGPT itself is maybe not even like anything unique technologically. The same insights, the same ideas have been floating around for a couple of years. But I think this is the first time that people are really getting the opportunity to play around with it. And then, sorry, what was the second half of the question again?
Yeah, it was, I think you answered most of it, right? How does ChatGPT work on neural networks? How does the model differentiate itself from heuristic-based models, even if it uses the same type of data?
Right. Yeah. So the thing I'd add there is that there are no like heuristics or rules hard-coded into the model. Everything is learned statistically just by like seeing all these examples of data out there on the internet. And so this also like ties back to the sort of like random behavior or possible like differences you might see when submitting the same prompt. So because the model doesn't have these like hard-coded heuristics of, you know, you see this sentence, you always respond with this answer. Maybe it will like 80% of the time output some kind of answer, 20% of the time output a slightly different answer.
With a follow-up technical question from probably somebody from a CS background. Since the model manages big data, how does it interpret and store these? Hive, Hadoop, or does it have another method to acquire and store the data?
Yeah, so the actual data itself is not being retrieved or accessed on the fly. So what happens is during this like pre-training and fine-tuning stage, what happens is we take all this data and we bake it into the model itself. And so the neural network, without going into like, too much technical detail, the idea of a neural network is it's represented by a set of parameters, just a set of numbers. And given those numbers, you have a formula for, given some input, you run a function on that input that's defined by those numbers and you get some output. And so those numbers are actually the only thing that's being stored. So there's no the like actual documents, the data itself is not being stored for something like ChatGPT on the fly. It's just those numbers that defines what the model actually is. And so when I say numbers, it's actually on the order of like billions of these numbers. So ChatGPT's predecessor, GPT-3, which was released in 2020 or so, was one of these like very large language models, had 175 billion parameters. And so, you know, as these models continue to get better, I'm sure they'll also like continue to get bigger. The idea is instead of storing the raw data itself, you learn as much as you can from the data and all the knowledge, all the information is stored in these parameters, these numbers that are sort of opaque, sort of a black box, but really capture the essence of what was there in the data.
Now that you mentioned GPT-3 and ChatGPT, again, for the lay audience, what do these acronyms GPT stand for? What do they mean?
So GPT stands for Generative Pre-trained Transformer. And so the T transformer is the name of the architecture. So that's like the specific configuration and how these parameters are oriented, the specific like mathematical formula that that defines this like input and output relationship. The transformer itself is a technique that I think came out in 2016 or 2017 from Google actually, that just turned out to be really good at manipulating all this data. And so it has really taken off within the field. So that's what the T is. The G, generative. Generative because these models can generate new text, can generate new data. So given some input, can generate a new output. And then the P for pre-trained, because we're training these models on data that's out there on the internet, data at internet scale, as opposed to collecting a lot of examples of here's a sentence, here's what the output must be. Instead of collecting examples that say, write me a poem and then what a poem looks like, we instead just take the entire internet and pre-train it on all the data that exists on the internet.
So you had mentioned before that ChatGPT is trained on data available in 2021. For a user, what else does he need to know when he's interacting with ChatGPT? This is another question from the audience.
A user should be aware that there is this data cutoff. So asking about current events is probably not a good
idea. Besides that time, they also mentioned there were some things like, you know, some document they were looking for that used to be available and no longer available. You know, there seems to be some regression in some answers, or, you know, some blockages in some answers. And why is that? And, you know, just expanding a bit on that.
So I think the other thing to be aware is that the answers you get for different questions for the same question can be a little random, can change naturally. So even if the model itself is exactly the same, if I submit a question and then at the exact same time you submit a question, because of the way these are trained, because of this idea that the model doesn't know exactly what the next word is going to be, it just knows that 80% of the chance it's word A or 20% of the chance it's word B, you can submit the same prompt two different times and gets two completely different answers. So that might be one reason why something that worked well in the past doesn't work as well today. Also update the model relatively frequently, trying to improve general capabilities, trying to make it better on general question answering. And so hopefully the trend is that as time passes, these models get better and better, but for individual questions, it might be the case that the model has gotten worse on that individual question.
Okay. So there's nothing specific that is being blocked because something, you know, somebody was looking for some sales agreement draft, didn't find the same answer, you know, a day or two later, but you're saying there's nothing specifically that you're doing for that specific question answer. It's just you're updating a model and then it's anyway a heuristic way of figuring out the next word of the answer, and that's how it works. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah, exactly. I will say there are instances where, say, we notice someone is using the tool to generate fake news or generate hate speech. In those instances, then we will specifically collect data to teach the model that doing those things is bad.
Bad.
You might see a common response that, I forget the exact wording, but I'm a large language model trained by OpenAI. I can't help you with such and such request.
Right.
Yes. So those aren't necessarily hard-coded, but we are very careful about thinking about, what are the ways people are abusing this technology or using it in ways that have negative impact, and making sure that the model isn't being used in those cases.
I want to just take a slight this thing, and then I'll take more questions from the audience. You talked a little bit about your internships at Tesla Autopilot and Google Search, right? How did that help you get this role at OpenAI, and how did you transition from high school to get these internships in the first place? And, you know, can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, definitely. I think a lot of what this ultimately comes down to is building your credibility, building your portfolio. Uh-huh. The way I view my journey was that in high school, I started off doing a lot of projects on the side, building games with my friends, building little mobile apps. Nothing that I should be particularly proud of, nothing that would actually make money at a real company, but things that I enjoyed doing just because I was passionate about it.
Right.
And so the very first work opportunity I had was with this professor. And the only reason I was able to get that opportunity was I made this website that showcased all these projects I was doing on the side, what these apps were, what these projects were. And he just, he knew I didn't have any official work experience, but he liked the fact that I was spending my free time working on these things, that it was something I was passionate about. I think his impression was, even if I don't have the knowledge today, as long as I dedicate myself to it, I'll be able to pick it up in the same way that I was able to pick up these side projects and side passions. So that was a really formative, transformative opportunity for me, where I was able to learn sort of on the fly what good software engineering principles are, what good programming skills are. Worked with that professor for a few different summers when I was in high school. And then was able to use that opportunity to get these like next jobs, these next internships. So with that experience I had, you know, I had more to show off on my portfolio, more to talk about on my resume. When interviewers had questions for me, I could answer them more intelligently because either like the questions they had were lived experiences that I could talk about, or I could talk about other things I worked on with these like side projects.
Okay, so what you're saying is your journey from a student, higher transitioning from a student to getting an internship and doing some projects, showcasing the projects, making them visible to, you know, where you apply for an internship, and then those internships themselves become showcases to get a real job. That's kind of right, your journey, right?
Exactly.
So it's very interesting, and that's really what MySphere is about. You know, in fact, for the audience, I can just briefly show. Right, so we have a lot of curated stuff on different career paths on MySphere. Right, for those of you in the audience who haven't seen it, whether y'all are students or student administrators or principals, right? And so there's a lot of curated career paths of over 25 different careers, right? And a student can use the platform to kind of showcase, you know, his own goals, a little bit about himself, where he studied, some of the other courses he's done, and start building a portfolio, right? And so, so for example, this is a student's portfolio. You can see the screen. The student called Shiv Malhotra starts creating his portfolio. And, you know, if he's done, let's say, a home automation project, right? And as part of doing the home automation project, he can, you know, upload a video while making the project and upload some pictures of the project. Maybe he's doing some 3D printing or anything. And it can, doesn't need to be a STEM project, right? It might be something that he's doing in music or theater, but, you know, so depending on the job he's applying for, he starts building a portfolio. And the platform allows one to create a CV as well, and then apply for and be a platform as a marketplace for finding internships. So in fact, any students who have actually registered for this talk can apply to a bunch of internships. We have some coding internships, social media internships, and we're going to offer 10, we're going to pick up 10 interns from, you know, anyone who registers today in the talk as well. Right? So that is the interesting insight, Vineet, that you shared on your own journey transitioning from high school to being an intern to, you know, working at a company like OpenAI. I'll now switch back to questions from the audience. We have a couple of minutes. Maybe we can take even verbal questions. Yeah, Rashmi, maybe we can take a question from you. You raised your hand.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I did want to ask primarily about ChatGPT. So there is a concept of heuristic learning, like you said, where you're discovering things and you're learning things as that information is being fed to you. And I came across an interesting example. So when somebody creates an academic paper for completing their doctorate, their postdoc, they have to use a style of formatting. There's this particular student that was using APA style, and they were playing around with ChatGPT, and they asked a simple question. They said, can you give me the rules for the current APA style of formatting for an academic paper? And it immediately gave APA version 7, which is an outdated version. The current version is APA 8. So the student goes ahead and says, well, you're giving me the version 7 rules. APA 8 is the current version. And this AI is so polite, it says, oh, I'm so sorry, you are right. It is APA 8. Let me give you the rules for that. And then it went on to dictate the APA 8 rules perfectly. Now, the student wanted to play around some more. So it said, well, APA 9 has also come out. So can you give me the rules for that? And like it was mentioned earlier, it did give out rules imitating the older versions and said, here you go, I'm so sorry, you're right, APA 9 is the correct version, the latest version. Now, APA 8 is a 2019 rule, so it is before 2021. There is no reason for it to, you know, think otherwise. But because a person fed it wrong information by saying, oh, there's also another new version, APA 9, it went ahead, corrected itself, and gave, well, misinformation. This is something that when I've interacted with AI students, I've always learned this from them, where they say the interesting part of heuristic training is trying to differentiate between misinformation and facts. And how is ChatGPT, particularly ChatGPT, focusing on, I guess, clearing out the misinformation and perhaps not becoming the AI of Wikipedia, because Wikipedia kind of came in, a lot of information, people would go in and edit it. And ChatGPT right now is also in the same throes because it's like a toddler. So
yeah,
what-
Rashmi, if I can interrupt. So just crisply, the, you know, just ask your question in one line, possible, in the interest of time.
So, so what is the current training? Like how does the ChatGPT development team look into training ChatGPT to distinguish between an actual question and then a person that is basically misleading the AI to give a wrong answer?
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. This is a really good question. I think it's something we think about a lot. I think it's also the kind of thing where we don't have a perfect solution yet. So right now we're trying a lot of things with the hopes that one of them will help, many of them will help, but they'll all sort of work together to improve the system. So a few of the things we're doing, one is just like generally as we continue to build bigger models, one of the things we hope to observe is that these bigger and better models will be more factual. They'll just absorb more of what they've learned from the internet, and we'll know what is something that's correct, what is something that's wrong. We also are like very much interested in collecting real data of, you know, when are humans trying to trick the AIs? Actually, the year is like 2030, and we have APA version 12 out now. And so this is something we like actively collect data on, but it's also something that like a lot of ChatGPT users do for us. And so one thing that's really been powerful for us is anytime someone's playing around with ChatGPT and they hit the thumbs down button on response, we are able to collect that data and automatically figure out, this is something that's bad, we want to do less of this, let's update the model to do less of those bad things. So we do sort of naturally get some of these where like humans are trying to trick the AI, but it's, since it's like something we've also observed, it's something that we like specifically collect data about as well. The like final thing I'll add is, I think this touches back to Girish's point earlier that maybe like right now, search is one thing where you can like go to different websites and see like how factual those websites are. And then this AI chat is another thing. But maybe in the future, like these two sort of like evolve together or work together more consistently. So like maybe these chatbots are also able to do searches and like pull up new information. And so it can, you know, it can ask Google what's the current year, and it sees that the year is 2023, and it knows, hey, this person is trying to trick me. This doesn't really make sense. I'm not gonna help the person who's trying to trick me.
Right.
I see. So it's going to be a couple of years till ChatGPT passes the Turing test, you're saying.
I won't make any specific predictions there, but I definitely do think there's a lot of work for us to do. Yeah.
Thank you for answering that.
No. Thank you for the question.
Yeah. So in fact, as a follow-up on the Turing test, right? Does one need to know a little bit more than, you know, the next word in order to? So what is really thinking, right? I mean, it kind of goes into the fundamental question on what is knowledge, what is thinking, and then it becomes really blurred on what human beings concept of what thinking used to be is being, you know, definitely being challenged here, right? And so,
yeah, it's a very provocative question. I think one that's not one that we can answer purely technically, you know, one that has a lot of, requires like a lot of philosophy, requires a lot of spiritual understanding.
Right.
Definitely not something that we can think about on our own.
Yes.
I think it is very interesting to think about, if I could create something that could perfectly predict the next word you're going to say all the time, or could it perfectly predict the next word I'm going to say all the time, and I consider myself intelligent, does that mean this dumb prediction thing is also intelligent if it's doing the same intelligent things that I'm doing?
Right.
But at the same time, like, it doesn't have the same like biological mind I have. If you believe in a soul, maybe it does, maybe it doesn't have a soul. It's the lines become very fuzzy and blurred here, but it's definitely an interesting topic to think about.
So on that note, if there are no other questions from the audience, I'd like to thank Vineet for his time today. As one can imagine, being part of the OpenAI team, he's got a really, really busy schedule, but he kindly agreed to be part of the talk, and he's quite excited to be. I think throughout his journey, he's loved to mentor students, and this is just an extension for him. And so, again, thank you, Vineet, for that. There's also a feedback form that has been posted in the chat. I'd love you all the audience to fill out the form, and we do look at the feedback to improve on the sessions and to choose new topics to cover in future talks with other guests as well. So do give feedback on that. And as last, a reminder for students and for student administrators to tell their students that anyone who signs up to MySphere today, it can be eligible for applying for an internship, provided they have the right skills, right? And so on that note, I'd like to call an end to the session. Thank you again, Vineet. I'm much obliged for you joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me on here. This is really fun.
Yeah, thank you. Goodbye.
Bye. Take care.